We are doing Pirkei Avot, and we're up to the fifth chapter, what would be the 15th Mishnah in many editions of the Mishnah, or the 18th Mishnah in the Art Scroll Mishnayot. Our Mishnah discusses those who are sitting before the wise men. So the previous Mishnah discussed those who go to the academy. They're going to the Beis Medrash to learn, and our Mishnah discusses those that are there. I see we have a new face over here, Baruch Haba. What's your name?
Gavin.
Could you spell it?
G-A-V-I-N.
Ah, Baruch Haba. Where are you from?
British Columbia.
Oh, yes, sir. Welcome. Okay, so Gavin, we'll just go around the room. You'll get to know everyone. Tell us your names and where you're from, okay?
Was that a spare one in English?
I don't know. Let's just go around the room quickly. You met everyone, Gavin?
No.
No, okay, so let's go. What's your name?
Nathan.
Where are you from?
Shmuel.
Yeah.
You met already.
No, I'm Monroe, New York.
No.
Yosef Ardakis.
Yeah, Greece.
Yosef's our Madrid this week. David?
Wait, David, how's your name?
My name is David. I'm from Israel, born in Norway.
And Yitzhak from? Romania. Okay, so we're up to the fifth chapter, Pirkei Avot, the 15th Mishnah. And in some editions of the Mishnah, it's the 18th Mishnah, in Art Scroll Sidurim. And we'll begin. Our previous Mishnah discussed those who go to the Beis Medrash, those who go to the academy, and the wages, and actually making the trek to learn, that in and of itself deserves wages. And our Mishnah discusses those that are sitting there. Alba Midot are four types of people, the Yoshvedi Pnei Chachamim, among those that are sitting before the wise men. They've already come to the academy, and the question is, what are they going to get out of it? So there are four types of students. The Mishnah says, Sfog, a sponge, Umashpech, and a funnel, Meshameret, some kind of sifter, Vinapa, which is another type of sifter.
So, a strainer.
Okay.
As opposed to a sieve.
Okay. So the Mishnah explains now. Sfog, the student is like a sponge, Shu Sofeget Hakol, he absorbs everything. The teacher teaches, he absorbs everything he says. But he's not so sharp because he doesn't know what's the main point and what's the less important point. What he doesn't know how to discern. He just knows how to regurgitate. Whatever he hears, he knows.
It also mentions the true and false, not just meaningful.
Okay.
Trivial.
Okay. So he just knows how to spit back whatever he hears. So at least he knows what he's learned. Svogshu Sofeget Hakol. The sponge just absorbs everything. That's a student who absorbs everything he hears. Mashpech, a student who, how do they translate a mashpech? A funnel. Shemachnis bezo, matzi bezo. Goes in one ear, comes out the other ear. The Torah just flies through it. He forgets everything he learned. Meshameret, what?
What's the good thing about the guy who learns the Torah and forgets it? Like you said, there's some good in the sponge. What's the good in
that? So the simple understanding is that this guy, he doesn't gain anything. But the Medrash tells us, there's a Medrash that the Rav Soloveitchik was fond of quoting. The Medrash says, the Torah, people complain they don't remember Torah, and they have to know that we have to do our maximum to learn and retain, to take notes, to review what we've learned. We have to do the maximum to really hold on to the Torah that we've learned. And at the same time, we have to know that there's a benefit to the Torah that we've learned, even when we've forgotten it. How so? So the Medrash says, it's like a king who comes to subjects, he comes to a town one day, and he says, I want you all tomorrow to take off from your work. I'm going to bring barrels. You all go to the river, fill the barrels with water, and go over there to the ditch down yonder, pour the barrels into the ditch, and then go back, refill the barrels, and pour the water into the ditch. All day long, that's what I want you to do. The subject say, whatever you say, we love you, our king. We're all taking off from work, we'll do it tomorrow. The next morning, bright and early, everyone goes to the riverbank, And the king sends a few wagons. They show up with barrels. All the townsmen take the barrels. Each one goes to the river, fills up the barrel, starts going over to the ditch. As they're walking to the ditch, each one sees that his barrel's leaking. He tries tilting it to this side, that side. The barrel's leaking. By the time they get to the ditch, there's very little water left. They throw it into the ditch. They try a second time. They try a third time. They see the barrels are filled with holes. They drop the barrels and they say, the king must have not realized. He must have made a mistake. All these barrels are filled with holes. Can't be this what he meant us to do. They drop all the barrels. They go back to their work. One guy says, this is what the king asked us to do. This is what I do. I don't know. The king said to do this. This is what I do. At the end of the day, the king comes riding up with his men. He sees only one man working. He calls in all the townspeople. He says, what's going on? So they said, we all showed up in the morning. We started working. We noticed that the barrels were filled with holes, so we figured we're not going to fill the ditch this way. This can't be what you meant for us to do. So the king says, fools, I told you to do something. You have to do it. Wait, what are you trying to figure out what I told you to do? I didn't need that ditch filled with water. I need the barrels clean. I want you guys to go to the ditch, and as you go, you'll shake the barrels, and the water will come out of the barrels and clean out the barrels, and by the end of the day, I'll have clean barrels. I didn't ask you to figure out what I want. Says the Medrash, the same thing is true with the Torah. God gave us a mind which can retain only so much, and we forget. That's the way it is with Torah. We do the maximum to remember. But we have to know that when the Torah goes in one ear, and eventually it starts trickling out the other ear, well, it cleans out some of the schmutz, cleans out some of the dirt in our mind as it goes out. The Torah that goes through us cleans us, makes us a better person.
That's the best way of putting it, actually.
So, that's the Medrash. That's what Rav Soloveitchik liked quoting. We have to, on the one hand, we have to know we have to do the maximum to retain the maximum. On the other hand, we also have to know that at the end of the day, after we've done our best to retain the Torah, even though we've forgotten, the Torah still makes us a better person. So you asked, what's good about the guy that's like a funnel? Everything goes out. There's still something good. Still something good. Mishameret. So the one who's like some kind of a filter. So he's shemotziat ayin mekoletet et hashmarim. This filter, all the wine goes out, but it holds up the sediment. So too you have students that they only remember the stories. They come to Beis Medrash, they forget all the halachas, they forget the little nonsense, the joke that the Rebbe cracked at the beginning of the class, that they remember. Everything else they don't remember. They retain the sediment, but they don't get the wine. Motziat ayin. This is a type of filter which it's like
it's sort of like, is it like one of those things that looks kind of like a ladle with very fine, like
basically it's a thing.
It's like a cheese bag.
It's like tea, you know, the tea powder when you put it, you strain the tea out and the powder.
It's like the thing they have in windows to keep the bugs out.
Okay, so the sediment stays on top and the wine drips out on the bottom. Vinapa, and napa is a type of filter that they had. Shemotziata came out that let out all the coarse flour, vikoletet et hasoled, and it would hold on to the fine flour. So you have some students that they know how to retain all the perfect things, all the good things from the learning. They can figure out exactly what's the most important thing in what they've learned and what's right and what's not right. They know how to discern. So the Mishnah, to an extent, is telling us, like the previous Mishnah, and like the earlier Mishnayot in the chapter, that we had Mishnah Yud Beis, that some students have this capacity and others have that capacity. We all have a responsibility to get to the top of our capacity. We're all expected to do our maximum. But we have to recognize that different people have different potentials. Like the Beis Elokim, the Mabit, was a contemporary of Rav Yosef Karo. This is one of the first concepts he discusses. He says, when we come to the world to come, God is not going to judge us based on someone else. God judges each person based upon their own potential. We learn Eov late at night. It goes up on the web at the Torah for Me site. So in our Eov class, we're learning right now, Sofar HaNa'amati, one of Job's friends, that's the claim he's making to Eov. You, Job, you claim you've lived a pious life. God doesn't judge you just based upon what you've done. God judges you based upon your potential. You've done good things, but you know how much better you could have lived your life. That's Sofar HaNa'amati. That's one of Eov's friends, that's what he claims to you. You know why you're suffering? Because you've compared to what you could have been, you're very far from that.
But so, friends were supposed to be ignorant and not know what the deal really was.
So ask whoever taught you that. What they meant by that. I don't know.
This is the story of the deal. Okay, it's a far off topic, but it's really like a shameful story because like Eo is a good person, a God's just letting him be tested. So this thought that he's only getting tested because he's not as good as he really could be is false.
I didn't say that Sofar HaNa'amati's claim is accepted. Every friend that makes a claim, Eov refutes his claim. But at the end of the day, we do learn things from his friends as well. That's a different discussion. That's a discussion for the class in Eov. Do we? How much we learn from his friends when Eov seems to refute all of their claims? But at the end of the day, we do learn things from their claims, and this is what one of his friends claims, and that's why I began with the introduction that the Mabit, he's not writing a claim by someone, he's writing bottom line, that this is a concept we have to know, that we're each gauged based upon our own potentials. And so when these Mishnayot tells that different students have different potentials, we have to know that they, to an extent this teaches us take it easy. You don't have to live up to what he's doing. If he's catching on 10 times as fast as you, fine. So long as you've done your maximum, that's what God wants of you. And that's why the Mabit says, you know, you could have one person who accomplishes a tenth of the other person, and yet in the world to come, he's going to have 10 times as much as the other person, because he's reaching his potential. And even though the other person is doing 10 times as much, but he has potential to do even more, and he's not reaching his potential. We're each gauged based upon our own potential. Now, so that's why the Talmud says, before you're quick to decide, I can't succeed at this, give yourself 3 years for certain areas of Talmud, 5 years for other areas of Talmud. Before you decide how talented you are, you got to give yourself a long time. Certain things the Talmud says, some people are gifted and some people aren't, when it comes to memorizing things. So there are tricks, there are things that help, but at the end of the day, some people have more talent and some people have less. And other things, it depends on the work you put in, and every person has their own potential, and that's what these Mishnayot are teaching us.
I got a question.
Yeah.
Let's just say there's a student, he's very learned, he has good memory and everything, but the only language he understands is, let's say, English. And he memorized the entire Talmud, you know, the Torah, everything. But he doesn't understand a thing, because it's in Hebrew. So is this a good student? And because he doesn't understand it, but he memorized it.
So we don't give so much value for things that are just repeated by rote. Meaning a person, that's the first example, a person who's a spoke, he's a sponge. It's not the best. All he could do is regurgitate. He heard this, he could spit it back. Great. A person's supposed to do more than that. We're supposed to process what we've learned, and it's supposed to become a part of us, and we're supposed to develop it. Each of us has a role in Torah that only we can discover. When God made the Torah, God made it that every Jew has a section in Torah that only he can discover. And if we uncover it, so that much Torah will be uncovered in the world. And if we don't, so it will remain covered.
You know what the third thing is like? A pot. You know, like when you make pasta, you pour the pasta in.
Colander. Okay. Mishnah Tet Zayin. The next Mishnah teaches us about love. Kol ahava shitluya b'davar. If you have love, but it's contingent on something, it's not a connection between two people, but it's contingent on something external. Like the guy who's dating a girl and he's sure he loves her. But for some reason, her father's millions and the Rolls Royce in the car are what catch his eye. So he might think he loves her, but what does he love? Or the guy who's dating the rabbi's daughter and he's sure he's in love with her. But he keeps thinking about the fact that his father-in-law is going to be the chief rabbi. There are all kinds of examples. Or the guy who's dating a girl and her beauty is what attracts him. At the end of the day, this isn't love. So we call it love, but we call it ahava shetluya badava, love that is contingent on something external. Batel dava, when that thing will be annulled, and things do pass in the world, chief rabbis change, money comes and goes, looks come and go. But la ahava, so then the love will also pass. V'sheina tluya badava, and when you have love that's not contingent on anything, eina b'tela leolam, that love will never be annulled. It lasts till eternity. What's an example of love that's contingent on something? Zo avat Amnon v'Tamar. That's the love of Amnon for Tamar. Amnon said he loves Tamar. Amnon begged to have Tamar. Amnon was ill because he couldn't live without Tamar. Amnon did everything he could just to get Tamar. Finally, he figured out a plot and he got Tamar into his room and he had Tamar. And 5 minutes later, he kicked her out like a dog and told his servant, lock the door after her. What happened? I thought you loved her. You were so sick. You couldn't live without her.
Oh, he has the Madonna whore call.
Ah, so tells us the Mishnah, because he didn't love her. It was contingent on something external. And this is something to think about. Because Some very often people enter marriage with Western concepts. Our second class tonight is going to be about the Jewish home. And very often, especially today, it's very interesting. I've been dealing in Shidduchim for about a decade now. And I can tell you, I see the difference the last 3 years and the first 5-6 years I was dealing in Shidduchim. The last few years, everyone's talking to me about looks. I don't know, that wasn't the case 10 years ago. And I'm telling you, I don't know what changed, because the Western world's been Western for a long time. But maybe it's already become a part of the Jewish world. I don't know why. I don't think that's it. Once upon a time...
But how long can physical beauty last?
Forget that. No. But are you going to really love the person? We say... Sure. What do we say in Eishes Chayil, the woman of valor? We say, Sheker Achein Vehevel Ayofi. The beauty is fools. The beauty is vanity. It passes. Ishai Rat Hashem, when you have a God-fearing woman, and on top of that you have beauty, then you could praise it. But you got to have the essence. There's nothing wrong with beauty. You see, the Imos, the matriarchs, were blessed to be beautiful. You see, Chava was Eve. She was beautiful. Esther, questionable whether she was beautiful or not. Sarah was beautiful. Rachel was beautiful. Rivka. You see, Rivka was also described as beautiful, right? It's an asset, but it's not the main thing. And we want to build love that's not contingent on something external. Love that connects, that's a real connection. What's an example of that? What's an example of ahava she'inat luya b'davar? Love that's not contingent on something external. Zo ahavat David v'Yonatan. That's the love between David and Yonatan. We have a situation where the king is King Saul, Shaul HaMelech. He has a son-in-law named David. And David is very successful in all his military campaigns. The girls are singing, Shaul kills his thousands, and David takes down 10,000. They're praising David more than Shaul. Who should take the throne after Shaul? The logical continuum would be Yonatan, his son. Yonatan knows that right now, the way things look, the people have it, they're focused on David, that he'll take the throne. Now, this is the beginning of the kingship. I mean, our first king was Shaul. So if it breaks from Shaul now, there's a good chance that David will take the throne and his children will continue the dynasty. If Yehonasan takes the throne, then he's strengthening it within Shaul's family. What does the Tanakh tell us? Yehonasan loves David. Yehonasan loves David of true love. And that's why when David eulogizes Yehonasan, he says, Nifle'ata ahavatcha li. Your love for me was so amazing. Me'avad nashim. More than the love between men and women. Because men and women, sometimes that love can be contingent on all kinds of things. And your love for me was even at a cost, even though you were losing your own future. You knew that if you love me and you help me, and Yonatan tried helping David. He tried to tell Shaul, don't worry, David's not doing anything wrong. He tried to make peace between David and Shaul. Yonatan did everything he could to help David. And at one point, Yonatan told David, you'll be king and I'll be vice president. I know after my father dies, you will take the throne and I'll be under you. Yonatan really loved David. And that's why when we look for an example of love that's not contingent on anything, we quote the love of David and Yonatan. And we always focus on Yonatan. Because David had everything to gain from the relationship. And Yonatan had everything to lose from the relationship. And nonetheless, the Navi continually stresses that Yonatan really loved David. So that's true love. True love is when it's at a cost. You know, very often when a spouse says something stupid... So the husband or the wife, whoever said something stupid, the other one wants to laugh at it to distance themselves. That wasn't me, that was her. Or that wasn't me, that was him. Our Mishnah teaches us, even when it's at a cost, when you love someone, you stand by them. Yonatan stands by David even when it's at a cost to himself. Mishnah Yud Zayin. Kol machloket shidashem shamayim sofa leitkayim. When you have an argument that's really for the sake of heaven, so then the people are going to last. The people are going to last, and they'll have a chance to argue again and again, because they're not arguing an argument to the death. Neither one wants to kill the other one. Neither one wants to win the argument. They're both arguing for the sake of heaven. So when we're arguing for the sake of heaven, so we'll have ample time to disagree on other points as well, and it's not a fight to the finish. We don't have to win this argument. Each one can hold their opinion, respect the other one's opinion. We're seeking the truth, and we both understand that we're both seeking the truth, so we could continue being friends. V'sheina l'shem shamayim, but when you have an argument that's not for the sake of heaven, en sofa l'itkayem, then that argument, the people won't last, and the argument won't last. That their first argument is their last argument, because that's it, they're not going to talk anymore. Each one wants to finish off the other one. Because if our goal isn't the truth, if our goal isn't for the sake of heaven, then our goal is, I want to be right. If my goal is for me to be right, then the argument isn't over. You haven't yet conceded your loss. And if you're holding the same ground, so we're not going to have a second argument. This argument's going to last a lifetime, because it's not for the sake of heaven. What's an example of an argument that's for the sake of heaven? That's the argument between Hillel and Shammai. Each one loved the other one. Each one was seeking the truth just like the other one. And each one respected the other one's opinion, so they could argue. And then they argue a second time. Then they argue a third time. Because they love one another. We're both looking for the same truth. The Sheina L'Shem Shamayim, what's an example of an argument that's not for the sake of heaven? Zo Machloket Koch V'Chol Adato. That's the argument of Korach and his men. They came up to Moshe and said, you're a faker, you're a liar, you're just looking to gain honor for yourself. On their first argument already, by the end of the day, Korach and his men, we know the next day they're all swallowed by the earth, the men are consumed by fire. There's no time to have a second argument, because it's a fight to the finish. Notice that the Mishnah doesn't say Korach and Moshe, because Moshe was for the sake of heaven. But it's enough that one side isn't for the sake of heaven, and you can't have a second argument, because that side's going to fight to the finish.
The wording is kind of strange, because it's the argument you just said, arguments that aren't for the sake of heaven will keep going for the whole lifetime. But the wording they use here is, any dispute that is for the sake of heaven will in the end endure.
Correct.
Even
so we said
the one that will end is the one that endures, as opposed to the one that doesn't end doesn't.
So I don't know if you noticed, I said two explanations.
Right.
I said the arguers, the people, will endure,
right,
and their arguments will endure. They'll have continuous arguments because they can respect one another and continue talking.
Right, their respective views will be remembered, the Rambam.
Okay, it's another understanding. Mishnah Yudchet. Kol amzaket arabim. Whoever purifies, he gives chos. He teaches the masses and he helps the masses get merits. Enchet bal yado. God helps him that he doesn't sin, so that you won't have a situation where he sinned and he has to go to perdition, and all his students are sitting in the Garden of Eden. They're all having it good. God says, "You helped them get to the Garden of Eden. I'll help you get to the Garden of Eden. I'll help you avoid sin." And by contrast, all who caused the masses to sin. So in heaven they don't give him the capacity to make it to do tshuva. Meaning he could try, but in heaven they'll try to make it tough on him. Because if he's caused others to go to perdition, so God says, you've caused them to go to perdition, I want you to be there with them. I don't want you to sit in Garden of Eden while they're in perdition. Moshe zacha v'zikat rabim. Moshe merited for himself, and he brought merits to the masses. So the merits of the masses is contingent on Moshe. Shneimar, as the verse says, Tzidkat Hashem asa u'mishpatav mi'Yisrael. Moshe Rabbeinu did God's righteousness and the judgments for the Jewish people. It's as though he himself did it. He brought justice and righteousness to the masses in teaching them. And that's why Moshe Rabbeinu is the prime example of someone who brought merits to the masses. Yeravam, we know the king after Shlomo, we know the story, right? Shlomo's son Rechavam took over. Yeravam ben Nevot was initially so pious that God told him, me, you, and King David, we walk in Garden Eden together. Yeravam asked, who's first, David or me? God said, David's first. So Yeravam said, no thanks, God. And then Yeravam erected his own idols, and he wanted to ensure that the kingdom stays by him, so he led the Jews to worship golden calves again, and he changed the calendar, and Yeravam caused all the Jewish people to sin. Yeah?
Rabbi, the book that Solomon wrote was the Proverbs, right? Was it entirely written by him or some other sages as well?
King Solomon wrote Mishlei, Shir HaShirim, and Koheles, and there are parts of Tehillim.
Parts of Tehillim. And is it possible that King Solomon's wisdom was like without any faults?
What does that have to do with this?
No, I know.
So let's save it for Thursday night.
Right.
Yeah.
Regarding the, see, well, the this chapter, the modern shares are anonymous. Why is that?
I don't know.
Anonymous.
I never noticed it.
Some
I never noticed. So I don't know. Anonymous.
Anonymous.
Doesn't tell us who said these Mishnah. Wow, it's a good point. I never noticed it. I have to look into it. I don't know. I don't know of any. Thank you. I never noticed it at all. Tudarba. So Yeravam is the prime example of someone who sinned and caused the masses to sin. Cheta Rabim Taluibo. The sin of the masses is hung on him. Shenemaus, the verse says, Al Chatot Yarovam, Asher Chatav, Asher Echtit Israel, over the sins of Yeravam, that he himself sinned, and he caused the Jewish people to sin. It doesn't say over the sins of Yeravam and the sins of Israel. It says over the sins of Yeravam, that he sinned and caused others to sin. So this teaches us that the Torah holds him accountable, even though we're each responsible for our own actions. If he was the cause of sin, so he's also held accountable for others' sins. Mishnah Yutet, kol mi sheyesh biyado shlosha dvarim halalu, anyone who has the following three traits, mitalmidav shel Avraham Avinu, he is among the disciples of Avraham Avinu. And you'll notice here the Mishnah says Avram, and the Mishnah does not say Moshe. The Mishnah is stressing it doesn't matter Jew or Gentile. The following are three traits that makes a person as though he's a disciple of Avraham Avinu. These are three positive traits that makes a person a good person. Doesn't have to be a Jew. And that's why the Mishnah attributes these three traits to Avram. V'shloshat varim acherim, and anyone who has three other traits, mitalmidav shel Bilam Arasha, he is among the disciples of Bilam the wicked. What were Bilam's traits? We're going to see he had a bad eye. The word eye is a reference to the mind, the thought, the person's wisdom. And Bilam, he had desire that encompassed his physical and his spiritual and his intellectual. So his desire governed his world. And when it came to his thoughts, he used his thoughts to figure out ways for attaining his desires. And that's the Ayn Ra'ah. And then he had pride. And that's what we're going to say. He had a high spirit. And he had the physical desires, which also led his life. So that those are the three traits of Bilam. And Avram has the positive sides of that. What are the traits of Avram Avinu? Ayin Tova, a good eye. He uses his mind and his thought to do good things. To believe in Hashem and to be a positive person in the world. It says Veheemin Hashem. Avraham Avinu had emuna in Hashem. He used his capacity for thought. He used it for the positive. Veruach Nemucha, Ayin Tova literally means a good eye. When I see other people having things, I'm happy that they have it. I don't have to seek beyond what I have. I'm happy with my own lot. And I'm happy that others have it good. Now this is a very difficult trait. You know, that's what the Torah says, V'ahavta l'reacha kamocha. Be happy that your friend has like you. Usually, I don't mind if my friend has it good. I should just have it a little better. If I have it a little better than him, then I'm happy. But if he has it just as good as me, if he's as handsome as me, if he's as wealthy as me, if he's as happy as me, I'm not happy anymore. If he's good, but I'm a little better, then I'm fine. Torah says, "V'avtal reachok kamocha." Love that your friend has like you. That's tough. That's ayin tova. That's a good eye. I'll be happy when he has good. What do most people feel when they hear their friends doing the same job as them, earning twice the wages? Why does he have it so good? Yeah.
Don't most commentators approach that say in a more limiting fashion?
What do you mean?
They don't read it as equating the love for yourself with the love for
correct. What I said is a kutzkevart. Yeah.
Now, it's acceptable to be ambitious but still be humble, not if you can just say
it's a good thing to be ambitious. If I want for myself, there's nothing wrong with it. If I don't want someone else to have, then there's a problem. And the question is, why do I want and how much do I want? One of the traits that we're supposed to develop within ourselves is to be happy with the minimal amount. A person doesn't have to have a feast every day, to have steak every day for lunch, and to drive a fancy car or to drive a car altogether. A person has to think, what do I need in order to function well in this world? And a person has to be happy with what he has. Avraham Avinu had a good eye. The king of Sodom offers him everything, and he says, I have everything I need. I don't need anything more than that. And we find that throughout Tanakh. Moshe Rabbeinu was impoverished. He had one mule. He had to take his wife, his newborn baby, his other kid, on a mule through the desert. Now, he didn't have any money? No, he didn't. When the Jews were leaving Egypt, everyone was running around making money. Everyone knew the stocks were going up, right? It's like they all had hot tips. Everyone was getting wealthy. They walked out of Egypt. It says that Korach had 1,000 donkeys just to carry the keys to his storage houses. 1,000 donkeys to carry the keys. And he still wasn't happy. Probably one of the wealthiest people, if not the wealthiest person that ever lived. And he's still not happy because Moshe has it better than me. I don't have all the honor in the world. So 1,000 donkeys just to carry the keys. Think what that means, the storage houses. Everyone was getting wealthy. What was Moshe doing? He wasn't running around wealthy. He was looking for one more mitzvah.
Then why did Korah want to go back?
What do you mean, want to go back?
Didn't he want to go back to Israel?
I don't know. Where does it say that?
That was his sin.
Oh, the sin was that he questioned Moshe's prophecy, and he claimed that Moshe was a fake. He claimed that everything Moshe did was just for his own good. He claimed that Moshe was lying.
He
was questioning everything Moshe did. That's what Moshe said to God. God, if you don't intervene here, then everything's lost. You got to show the people. So the first thing is...
Wait, what happened to all this stuff?
Because
it all got swollen up. And I can't tell you where it is. Ein Tova, so the Mishnah says you got to have a good eye. That's the first trait of Avraham Avinu's students. The Ruach Nemucha, a humble spirit, extra modesty, humility. Avraham Avinu, when he's praying, he turns towards heaven and he doesn't say, God, look at what I've done. I changed the world. I stood up against the tide. God, come on, for me, you got to do something here. Doesn't say that. When he stands up in prayer, he says, what am I? V'anochi afal ve'efer. I'm dust and ashes, God. I know I have no room to ask you for anything, but please help me out anyways. Avraham Avinu doesn't come with his merits. If we'd be standing in prayer, we got 1,000 reasons why God owes it to us, right? God, look at what I've done for you, right? Avraham Avinu stood up against the tide. The whole world's pagan. He says, no, there's monotheism, there's one God. He's put in prison. He's a kid, he's in prison. He's in prison for 3 years. He doesn't see daylight. Then another 7 years. And God doesn't reveal himself. God doesn't make any miracles. God doesn't talk to him. He's fighting a lone battle. The whole world says he's crazy. They're trying to blind him, naturally. And Avraham Avinu sticks to his guns. And after that, he goes and he starts converting the world. He makes a revolution, a spiritual revolution in the world. And after he's done all of that, God's about to destroy the antithesis of Avraham Avinu. The people who God gave them potential to be the chosen people, the Sodomites, God gave them all the material blessing and they used it for bad. They used it to be harmful people to the world. They were Sodomites, right? Sodomy comes from Sodomites, right? Yalkut Shimoni in the beginning of last week's parsha.
Regarding them being chosen.
Yalkut Shimoni, it was in last week's parsha here. Listen to your last week's parsha here. You could see it in my notes online on Bamidbar. I quoted the Yalkut Shimoni in the notes. It's quoted by the Rabbein Bechaye, I think, in the beginning of last week's parsha. The Medrash compares them to the first wives of a king. That the Jewish people were the fourth or fifth wife of God, and the Sodomites were the third or the fourth. Look at the Medrash. We quoted it in last week's parsha. It's easy to remember. I just quoted it 4 days ago. I know you weren't here. Okay, when Avraham Avinu is standing, he's not even asking on his own behalf. He's asking on God's behalf. He's standing in prayer on behalf of the Sodomites. He has no claim. He says, "Anochi afal ve'efer. I know I'm worthless, God. I know I've done nothing to deserve it, but nonetheless, please help him out." That's modesty. That's humility. He doesn't take any credit for himself after all he's done. What's the third point? Ruach nemucha v'nefesh shefeila. a low spirit, a person that distances himself from the worldly pleasures. Avraham Avinu has been living with Sarah for decades. And at some point he's crossing the river and he sees a reflection in the river and he says, Sarah, I know you're beautiful now. Wait a second. You've been married for a few decades. Now you know she's beautiful? Yeah. Until now he never took the time to notice. That wasn't a part of their relationship. A person can be living with his wife for 30 years and he doesn't know that she's missing her two arms, because that's not what story in the Talmud. Tamimadlikin, second chapter, Shabbos. Why? Because he's a modest person.
Hey, Rabbi, if Sarah was childless for
just
so long...
Just like Yosef, yeah.
If Sarah was childless for so long, shouldn't Abraham have divorced her?
Like, good question. Let's wait either till we get to that parasha or a Thursday night. Yeah. Thursday night, we'll discuss it. Yeah, I know. For us, this concept that there's a relationship that's beyond the physical is very distant for us. That Avraham Avinu is married to his wife for decades and he doesn't know she's beautiful. We don't understand that. But then again, do we understand the Greek slave whose master was breaking his leg and he sat there? He had a very cruel master, but he wrote works of philosophy. I don't remember his name. And as he's breaking his leg, the slave tells him, if you keep twisting it, it will break. And the master says, I know. And he keeps mending it, and the slave says, in a second it will break. And he says, I know. And then he breaks it. He says, I told you. Do we understand that? And the Amora, who was lying in the room, and he was a kohen, and his son was there, and he had to have his leg amputated, and he tells them, and his son was sitting there to give him strength, and he tells them, tell me before you finish amputating it, when there's a little hair's width left connecting my leg, tell me. And as they're cutting it off, they tell him when they're up to the last hair's width, and he tells son, now you got to leave, because after they completely sever my leg, then it's going to be metame, then it's defiled, and you're not allowed to be in the room with the severed leg. And he sends his son out, and then it comes off. That we understand? We don't understand. In Abaya, you used to learn all week.
It's a story, right? So.
What are you going to say? All these are allegories. No, and Abaye, that the Talmud says, used to focus while he was leaning on his thumbs. And he was so focused in his learning that the weight on his thumbs caused them to bleed. And he wouldn't notice as the blood was spilling because he was focused on his learning. We understand. And Rava, who didn't untie his shoes all week long, because you put on your shoes Sunday morning, you take them off Friday afternoon because you learn all week. Who has time? And if someone asked him to pass the butter, that's it. He lost his focus for the week. That we understand. So we have tens of stories. They learn a different...
I don't tend like always... that's a last resort, perhaps. Take the allegorical...
I'm giving you examples of people who are generations later.
Great spirit, and they're much beyond our understanding. But like when you see such a midrash regarding Abraham, perhaps it's going to bring out...
Perhaps, perhaps, but I wouldn't run there.
Your
why do we have to go there?
I believe it's the epic Kedis.
Right, something with an E, I don't
know. Yeah.
Okay. And it's been a decade since I read those books, yeah.
I'm also saying, a lot of people hear this, some people hear this and misunderstand it.
So I'm saying, wait a second. Why, if you could have a Greek slave, Epictetus, who could have his leg broken and could be completely logical about it, so we have to understand that there were people on a different level than us. So Avraham Avinu, who was much greater than that, could have a relationship with his wife where her beauty is not something that's a part of their relationship.
I mean, completely logical. Like that example you brought, of course, it's the narrative that's describing a certain situation. So it's, of course, it's coming to give you, to bring you a certain idea of what was happening.
And if I told you that in our century, there was a rabbi who was in the car and they slammed the door in his hand as he was reaching for the seatbelt, and he didn't say a word until they drove away because he didn't want to embarrass the person. And after the car drove away, like the car pulled away, and when they hit the next light, he tells the driver, just a second. He opens the door and pulls his hand in from the door after they slammed the door in his hand, and he didn't say a word, and that's a known story. That's not an allegory. Yeah, there are people who have self-control. There are. Yeah. There are other stories. I can tell you other stories.
And I'm not doubting every strange story. But regarding a couple, they're living together. They're living in extremely high levels of kedusha. Do we necessarily have to explain it? Does it not have any concept of your physical appearance? Your physical beauty?
Why does that bother you?
No, it just never really sank in. Like, I used to really like this girl. I had no idea what her eye color was. You know, I feel like months. And then someone pointed out what her eye color was. It never even occurred to me to find out what her eye color was.
Yeah, but that's different.
But then again, if you don't notice that someone doesn't have arms, isn't that like really?
Okay, let's continue. So Avraham Avinu is extremely modest. That's not what interests him. It's like, you want to say it's allegorical, who could argue with you? I wouldn't run to say that. But we're going to see that the antithesis of all these traits is Bilam. So anyone who has these traits, we don't have to take it to the extreme of Avraham Avinu. Avraham Avinu was exceptionally pious. We have to be in that direction. We have to work in that direction. And anyone who has these types of traits, so he's mitalmidav shel Avraham Avinu, he's among the disciples of Avraham, our forefather. But what about the reverse traits? Ayin ra'ah, someone has a bad eye. He's not happy when other people have it good. He always wants more for himself. Bilam's always looking for more wealth. Beruach gvoha, he has a high spirit. He's describing himself. Bilam says, I hear God. I know God's thoughts. That's how Bilam self-described. Bilam describes himself. V'nefesh rechava, and he always has more desire and more desire. Bilam had so much desire that our sages say he even had relations with his mule. Yeah, Bilam, that's what it says. The mule tells was a special man. Was a special man. The mule, there's more depth to it.
Did his mule talk?
Yeah, donkey talks when he beat him on the way, you know, when he was about to curse. Yes.
No. there's a medrash that says that?
But the donkey was
really the same mule that was
alive. You say so? I don't know. Show me.
But his mule did talk.
That was an aton, and Mashiach is going to be Rochev al Achamor. But let's see, if you're saying there's a medrash, show.
But you're saying this mule is
over there, it's an aton, and by Mashiach it says chamor. I don't know how to translate chamor, and I don't know how to translate aton, but it seems to be two different things. But if you say so, I don't know.
Is it aton a male?
I think mule is different from donkey.
If I don't know, then I don't know the answer. I'm sorry, I don't know. So these are the two types of people we have. People that are interested in their own pride, people that are interested in monetary and material gain, people that are filled with desire, or people whose focus in life is not their desire, people who are modest and humble, who don't take credit for themselves, people who have a good eye and are satiated with what they have. And this has nothing, like we said, the Mishnah doesn't describe it as Jew and non-Jew. The Mishnah is specifically telling us, this is the type of person who's a disciple of Avraham. Avraham is Av Hamon Goyim, the father of many nations, as opposed to the students of Bilam, the wicked. A Jew should go with the good traits. A non-Jew should also go with the good traits. Everyone has a responsibility to go with the good of this Mishnah. So, one who goes in the ways of Bilam, one who goes in the bad ways is Mitalmidav Shel Bilam HaRasha, he would be from the disciples of Bilam the wicked. Ma ben talmidav shel Avraham Avinu talmidav shel Bilam HaRasha. What do we see is the difference between the students of Avraham, our patriarch, and the students of Bilam the wicked? Talmidav shel Avraham Avinu uchlin ba'olam hazeh. The students, those who go in the footsteps of Avraham, our forefather, they enjoy this world, v'nochalin ba'olam haba, and they inherit the world to come. Notice that the Mishnah is telling us this world. The Mishnah isn't only telling us the world to come. You live a better life in this world if your focus is not on the material, and if your focus is on being a good person, a kind person, being happy with your lot. Those of you who want, I just saw an article about how having appreciation is one of the keys to leading a good life. Reader's Digest came to this conclusion. I was a guest in someone's house, and they had this article in the bathroom. So those of you who want, I could try to get a copy of it. That this is one of the keys they came up with, that's the key to one of the keys to having a happy life is appreciation.
It's called an attitude of gratitude.
Oh, very good, an attitude of gratitude. Okay, so that's the Mishnah says, those who go in Avraham's footsteps enjoy this world and the world to come. But notice that the Mishnah stresses this world as well. Shneimar, as the verse says, Lanchil ohavai yesh, Ve'otzerotehim amale. The pasuk says, I will give those that love me, I will give them yesh, I will give them whatever yesh is, that's the world to come. Ve'otzerotehim, and their storage houses in this world, amale, I will fill. The word yesh, we find also in the last Mishnah in Shas, refers to the world to come. Don't ask me what yesh has to do with the world to come. You got to ask someone who knows the secrets of the Torah, and that's not me. So yesh means existence. Like Yishai. Why was Yishai called Yishai? Because the word yesh is a term for existence. The world to come is a world that refers to existence. Olam haba. It's always coming. It's never ending. There's olam hazeh. This not world here. That's this. Well, this is going to pass eventually. Then there's olam haba. The world that's always to come. It's always getting better. Right? In this world, we're always looking for a better thrill. And we're always disappointed. In the world to come, well, every day is better than its predecessor. It's always to come. There's always a future. There's a yesh. Yesh is existence. So that's a reference to the world to come. God says, I'll fill the storage houses in this world as well. But the disciples of Bilam the wicked, they inherit perdition. Then they go down to the depths, to the pit of perdition, of destruction. As the verse says, King David says to God, and these people, you'll take them down to the depths of destruction. When David speaks about the wicked, he says, Hashem, you'll take them down, men who have spilled blood, men who are filled with deceit, they won't even have their days, and I have faith in you. And this brings us to the concluding Mishnayot of the fifth chapter. The concluding Mishnayot of the fifth chapter, the simple understanding is that they're the concluding Mishnayot of Pirkei Avot. The sixth chapter, it is unclear where it comes from. It's probably brises that were added to Pirkei Avot. We will learn it, Bezat Shem, after Shavuot. But we're going to make a run for it, unless you guys veto me and tell me you prefer the Jewish home. And then we'll finish the fifth chapter next week.
The Jewish home sounds good.
How many people vote for the Jewish home? As usual. Okay, so finish the Pirkei Avot next week, Bezat Hashem.